Hello, and welcome to another edition of Physical Media Isn't Dead, It Just Smells Funny. Welcome back, everybody, to the September edition of Physical Media Isn't Dead, It Just Smells Funny. So just a little peek behind the curtain, part the kimono a little bit. I'm very busy lately. The Heartland International Film Festival is happening from October 7th through the 17th. And so between that and things happening at the IU Cinema and the regularity of the podcast, I've just been kind of busy, and that kind of coincidentally coincided with it just being a big month from the companies that I so graciously get these Blu-rays from. So I have already on the blog written out reviews for 4 out of the, 12, 13 movies that I received from my usual suspects, Kino Lorber, Criterion. We also have something from Code Red. We have a big release from Arrow Video this month, and it's just quite a bit. It's so big that I'm actually going to move another review from Fun City Editions to its own separate episode. So this month, because I am so swamped and I need to and want to get this out in like a timely manner and to devote my energies for October being a very special month, because October, I love horror movies, I love October, I just want to make that episode so good. So for this one, I'm going to try something a little different, and I'm going to give my picks of the month their own time to shine. But for the other ones that I don't have written reviews for, I am going to speed round. Now, this is not to say that these aren't worthy of my usual like 5 to 10 minute gushing of context and personal histories with the movie. It just means that I just don't have a lot of time to edit this episode, and that's like all cards on the table, just being very honest about it. But as crazy as it's about to sound, it's like an incredible month, especially from all the companies, but Kino Lorber really, really has an exceptional September. Like, I want to make it very clear that the next time there is a Kino Lorber sale happening, and obviously a sale for any of these companies, like, please support physical media. That's why I do this podcast every month. But if any of these companies have a sale, but if Kino Lorber especially has a sale, they've been putting out such high quality, oft asked for releases, and they've just been supplying them month after month in like a high quantity and quality. It's quite impressive. So I am going to go through very quickly 5 titles that I think that you should definitely check out that came out the month of September. And then we'll slow down a little bit and we'll discuss my 2 picks of the month. Please join me there. First up, we have the Steve Martin vehicle directed by Carl Reiner, personal favorite of mine and a personal favorite of my Cicada Cinema compatriot, Niall Arena. He's the one who introduced me to this film, as well as my former partner in comics, David Yoder. This is Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid is a 1982 film, which if you have seen a movie like Kung Pao, Enter the Fist, or What's Up, Tiger Lily, it is a classic. Steve Martin and Rachel Ward and Carl Reiner and Rennie Santoni have been inserted into classic Hollywood footage, specifically a lot of noir and dramatic romances featuring the likes of Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Kirk Douglas, Ava Gardner, Cary Grant, Alan Ladd, Veronica Lake, Burt Lancaster, Charles Laughton, Fred McMurray, Ray Milland, Vincent Price, Barbara Stanwyck, and Lana Turner. Not to mention all of the probably great smaller character actors that old Hollywood aficionados will see pop up in these films. But yes, this is a film noir where Steve Martin is playing a private detective who is getting deeper and deeper into a conspiracy. It is both a homage and a love letter and a parody of all those great old Hollywood films with very similar plots that we all know and love. Have now seen this movie about 4 times. I still die laughing at Steve Martin's let me make you some of my famous Java. Tears in my eyes. You should check this movie out on Kino Lorber. It comes with some special features and auto commentary by filmmaker Alan Arkush and film historian and filmmaker Daniel Kremer, as well as some radio spots, TV spots, and theatrical trailers. Next up, we have a double Vincent Price feature, which, what is a better double feature than a double Vincent Price feature? We have Roger Corman's final film in his Poe cycle, Edgar Allan Poe's Tomb of Ligeia. I think is how you say it, and shot up to a going to be on regular rotation classic for me, David Carter, Theater of Blood. So when Roger Corman came to the IU Cinema, I guess this was probably 2013 or 2014. I do have a vague recollection, or it just could be I read an interview with him in it many moons ago, that he said of all of his Edgar Allan Poe movies, Tomb of Legia was his favorite. And I remember taking, I was like, oh, really? Interesting. And now, upon rewatching it after many, many years, I have to agree, it's filmed so elegantly, which is such a strange thing to say for a Roger Corman film, even though I think Roger Corman actually has his moments as a very elegant filmmaker, no matter how cheap and fast he would make things. And obviously reusing those castles and sets from all the other Poe cycle films. But this is an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's famous story about a spooky cat, essentially. No, Vincent Price plays a widower whose wife has died, his wife was seeking immortality. And it appears to him as if his wife's spirit has been transferred into a cat and is terrorizing the new love of his life. This is a movie that stars Vincent Price and Elizabeth Shepherd. This is great. I would actually, after watching this, really love to revisit the Edgar Allan Poe cycle of films, which, for those listening to this who don't know, Roger Corman and AIP, adapting things from the public domain for very cheaply by reusing sets and actual castles and the same kind of company of players. Vincent Price, a man always seems down the clown, very theatrical. At this point, I don't really know what else I need to say about Vincent Price. I could just gush about him. The man, to borrow a phrase from film critic David Sims, when is he bad? I've never seen a bad Vincent Price performance. So at this point, just take it as a given that if Vincent Price is in it, the movie itself might not be great, but the performance is going to be exceptional. Elizabeth Shepherd, also exceptional in this film. I could gush more, but obviously I'm kind of pressed for time. So great movie. Please check it out. And makes for a lovely double feature, but not the double feature I would program if given the opportunity for the 1973 film directed by Douglas Hickok's Theater of Blood. This is such a partner to the film The Abominable Dr. Fibes. I am kind of surprised that it has not been programmed as a double bill in Bloomington at some point. But what Theater of Blood is about an actor who, after giving a performance that a bunch of critics just completely pan, attempts suicide, and is rescued by a bunch of drug-addled vagrants. I didn't say the movie wasn't without its problematic features, but proceeds to take revenge on all the critics according to different Shakespeare plays. Look, I gotta say, it's a cross-section of interest for me. Love Vincent Price, love Shakespeare, love revenge movies, love an actor putting on a lot of different costumes and doing a lot of business. That's why I like the movie Holy Motor so much. I mean, obviously, yes, it's a Vincent Price movie. There is a level of camp to it that I am enjoying. But also, it's just, you don't get to see a lot of movies like this. It kind of reminds me of the movie Greta or Ma, where, yeah, those are modern camp classics that the kids enjoy on the internet. But seeing it in it undistilled, there's no winking. Obviously, the people making this movie know how funny it is. There are some banger lines in this movie that I wish I had time to insert into this episode. But if you have the time to program this with The Abominable Dr. Fibes, or just want to watch this movie by itself, you're going to have a good time. So that is also from Kino Lorber. Special features include an audio commentary by screenwriter-producer Alan Spencer, audio commentary by film historians David Del Valle and Nick Redman. There's a Trailers from Hell segment with Alan Spencer. There's TV spots, radio spots, and a theatrical trailer. Once again, you can pick up those two movies from Kino Lorber. And from Code Red, who is quickly becoming someone I have been just enjoying the releases from, no misses so far, we have a movie starring a Ingmar Bergman regular, B.B. Anderson, also starring Robert Stack and James Ferrantino, Story of a Woman. This is directed by Leonardo Bercovici, who co-wrote The Bishop's Wife, and this tells the story of a Swedish concert pianist, played by B.B. Anderson, who falls in love with a handsome medical student named Bruno, played by James Ferrantino, who has been on this podcast before. He was in the movie Dead and Buried. as the dumb cop, which I love. But when she discovers that he's already in a relationship with a much older woman, she leaves and falls in love with Robert Stack, who you probably know from Unsolved Mysteries if you're of a certain age, which unfortunately for me, it's just anytime I see Robert Stack, I'm immediately terrified just because that is a terrifying show for young David Carter. And during this romance, things come back up. Bruno comes back. James Frantino comes back. And it becomes this kind of love triangle where she has still these feelings for James Frantino. And Robert Stack, who's an American diplomat, is trying to keep tabs on what's happening because they have returned to Rome. It is a very well acted movie. And for, you know, we don't get a lot of like dramatic romances like this these days. It's just so beautifully composed and shot and like staged, and the music, which is by a pre-Star Wars, Jaws, and blockbuster in general, John Williams, and his very classical score mixing with like the European pop that's playing throughout the movie. It's a whole vibe, as the kids say. I like this movie quite a bit. It's actually a movie I plan on revisiting with some other people just to kind of see. It feels like one of those hidden gems that I so love. So yes, if it so moves you and you are a big Ingmar Bergman fan and you're a big fan of his regulars, or you're just like a big Unsolved Mysteries fan, you just want to see Robert Stack and B.B. Anderson smooch, I guess, you can check out Story of a Woman from Code Red. And finally, the final film in my speed round is something I feel very strongly about, talking about cross sections of theater and blood. This is a big old cross section for me, despite one of the interests not really being something that I participate in, but enjoy the culture of. We have All the Streets Are Silent, The Convergence of Hip Hop and Skateboarding, 1987-1997, which is a documentary directed by filmmaker Jeremy Elkin about this very specific time in New York when the hip hop scene was like out of its infancy, it's entering its golden era, and the skateboarding scene are coming up right at the same time. And you get to see footage, like skateboarding, early archival footage of people like Busta Rhymes and like Jay-Z, like rapping fast, which was like wild to see. So many other skateboarders and subcultural figures before it all kind of blew up and became this like commercial juggernaut. Like, this is covering the rise of New York. It's covering the rise of Supreme. They interview people like Rosario Dawson, who's associated with that scene, obviously because she was in the movie Kids. Any documentaries about subcultures before they became mainstream are great for me because we live in a time when subcultures like that don't stay subcultures for very long. With the advent of the internet, things that become popular kind of find their way into the mainstream no matter what, and they get commercialized and profited off of so quickly. And look, it's the music business, and skateboarding business is kind of the fashion business, and obviously those are the outcomes for things. But that beautiful period where it's like a melding and a pressure cooker, you know, not to sound like too much of a dork, but it reminds me of reading about like Minton's Playhouse and like how bebop got invented, and just because it was this insular pressure cooker that this incredible thing emerged out of that only so many people were privy to before it got like bought and sold and like watered down. It's a joyous documentary to watch. It doesn't really, if I had a criticism of this documentary, is that it doesn't really go into those things that I'm talking about near the end, which are kind of like, yeah, we made a lot of money, it's different now, I guess, but you know, it still continues on. And to an extent, what else can you really say about it? You can't go back to the past and change it, but I think there is some examination there that could be explored. But if you want a easy, like, just sit back, and if you're not familiar or love these subcultures, just sit back and learn something about them. I actually learned a lot. The New York scene, different New York scenes and New York eras kind of like passed me by so quickly, and like reading about them in history books, like, obviously knew both these things were happening in New York around the same time, and I didn't know it was this brief, beautiful convergence that was happening at the same time. So, All the Streets Are Silent, The Convergence of Hip-Hop and Skateboarding. You can find that also on Kino Lorber in collaboration with Greenwich Entertainment. And with that, speed round over. Now I can talk about my two picks of the month, Legend from Arrow Video and Mona Lisa from the Criterion Collection. So, Legend. There is a wellspring of information about the production of this movie and how it came to be, because this is a production design feast for people, and it's a performance feast from Tim Curry. And if you are as big a fan of Ridley Scott as I am, this is a fascinating film in his filmography. It's a fascinating film in the cultural zeitgeist at large. What is Legend? This is a film made after Ridley Scott's two groundbreaking films, Alien and Blade Runner. Interesting history of those films being that Alien immediately becomes this like big hit. It's a canonical horror masterpiece. And Blade Runner is this movie that it kind of becomes this like cult object until it eventually, you know, becomes the inspiration for so many things that we enjoy today. Which is then interesting because Blade Runner itself is born out of Jodorowsky's failed Dune. But the DNA that stretches for science fiction is insane, and I can't really get into it right now. Ridley Scott, director, I hope to talk about more on these episodes, but then also just in general because I find him fascinating. I love Ridley Scott. Him and his brother Tony Scott, along with a few other directors, were coming out of commercial filmmaking. But why I like the Scott brothers so much is that while they have all these like poppy aesthetics and so much of their filmmaking is completely visual, there's this like interesting working class ethos to all of their films. And there's also this like kind of disdain for rich people and people in authoritarian positions. I think people don't give Ridley Scott enough credit. The man's made like almost 50 films, and like I would say a good majority of them range between like good to masterpiece, and you know, they're not all great. But this film is born out of a collaboration with William Schwartzberg, I think is how you say it, who is a fantasy writer who is most famous for writing the 1987 film starring Robert De Niro, Angel Heart, a movie I still hope to get played at the IU Cinema someday. It's a fascinating movie. And this, I couldn't even get into the like context, but this is a movie about, it's gonna sound so dorky, but is a movie about Tom Cruise, who is probably miscast, but considering that Robert Downey Jr. and Johnny Depp almost played this role, I don't know. They were aiming for modern actors in like what is decidedly not a very modern role. But Tom Cruise is in love with Mia Sara, who voice is able to lure these two unicorns to her, and in the process gets one of them injured and has their horn cut off because Tim Curry, who is probably the most standout thing about this movie, both imagery-wise and just performance-wise and notoriety-wise, plays the Lord of Darkness. And if he's able to obtain both these unicorn horns, then darkness will fall over the land forever. It's a pretty straightforward premise, but the premise is not why you watch this movie. The movie is a type of cinema, and I think Ridley Scott is really good at this, especially at this period in his career, is that he's all about vibes, man. I don't really know how else to say it. Like, this is a movie that, while it's kind of this journey to go rescue Mia Sara because she's eventually kidnapped by darkness and to save the world from darkness overcoming everything, you really just sit there and admire the set design and let both the soundtracks play. Like, and I'll get to the both the soundtracks comment in just a second, because that's also part of this movie's lineage. The design for this movie had such a like talented cast of like creators behind it. I mean, most famously, Rob Bottin, who is fresh off of John Carpenter's The Thing, AKA, I mean, I don't think it's unfair to say probably the top five best practical effects movies ever made. But then in addition to that, like an army of designers and painters, and the cinematographer Alex Thompson, who is most famous for shooting such films as Year of the Dragon, Labyrinth, Alien 3, Demolition Man. I'm pretty sure he shot the 1996 Hamlet movie that I am such a big fan of. It's a sumptuous visual feast for the eyes. I think what Ridley Scott was going for is that he wanted to make a dark fairy tale movie, like a la the Brothers Grimm and those things. But where this movie like gets more interesting is that you have Tim Curry essentially playing the devil. He's called Darkness, but he is the devil in some of the craziest like makeup effects. But then in addition to that, this role makes Frankenfurter, which is why he was cast in the movie to begin with, because Ridley Scott liked his performance in that movie so much. It makes his Frankenfurter seem subtle. one of my best friends, when I watched this movie for the first time with him, he described Tim Curry's performance as being constantly aroused. And while that seems kind of blue, if you watch the movie, you'd be hard pressed to disagree with him. I don't know. Obviously, I guess what I'm beating around the bush is that this movie was kind of a commercial failure when it came out. It was a critical failure. I think Neil Gaiman said that, like, William Schwartzberg's scripts, there were like bits and pieces of intelligence there, but you know, the movie itself doesn't deliver on that. Okay, nerd Gaiman. I actually like Neil Gaiman a lot. Yeah, mixed reception, but like Blade Runner, which is why I think this is of a piece with that, it did find this cult following. It also found a cult following because it's coming out around the time of things like Labyrinth and Dark Crystal and Kroll. It's coming around this time when like fantasy having this resurgence and like D&D is becoming a bigger deal. It's still a niche, very subcultural thing, but it is entering the mainstream. But it does attain such cult status because, like most Ridley Scott movies, especially from this era, there are multiple cuts of this movie.
Just popping in here to make a correction, but not re-record all of this, so disregard some things I'm going to say here. I unfortunately made the mistake of thinking that there was just the international cut and the director's cut are the exact same cut of the movie. That is not the case. The international cut is the one that runs 93 minutes long, and the director's cut is the one that runs 113 minutes long. There is a U.S. cut, which is 90 minutes long. The international and director's cut share the Jerry Goldsmith score, but yes, the director's cut is like considerably longer than the international cut. So just my correction for this episode. Sorry about that, guys.
There is the international European cut, which is longer. It's 113 minutes long, and the music is by Jerry Goldsmith. And it's much more of like a swashbuckling, like very beautiful. Actually, I love Jerry Goldsmith. This is probably one of his finest scores. I run into the score quite a bit. And that is, I would say the European cut is preferred for me, I guess. But the American cut, which is 90 minutes long, has a score by the great dream pop group Tangerine Dream. And this is why I say this is such a like important film in vibes cinema. These two scores completely change how you are watching the movie and what you glean from it. The theatrical cut is like shorter. The US cut is shorter. It's essentially the same story. There's like things cut out. You don't get to like lay in the space more, which is why I like director's cut so much more, is that you get to like kind of just lie there and float in this like beautiful world that these people design. I could gush and gush and gush about it. Like, there's too much context to get to in this movie. And so this is why this is one of my picks of the month. If you are lucky enough to grab the Arrow Video Collector's Edition of this, it's the definitive edition of this movie. I had the Ultimate Edition that came out probably in like 2012 or something like that, which had both cuts of the movie. But this is just above and beyond as far as context. There are an astounding amount of special features. Every special feature that came on that original Blu-ray disc is on here. Arrow Videos have gone out of their way to offer new retrospective special features, going over the production design, both the scores, the design teams and special effects and makeups teams. I'm not going through each individual special feature because it's that loaded. There's commentaries with Ridley Scott. There's new commentaries featuring new people. There are things pulled from non-legend specific pieces of material, including a interview with Ridley Scott about his career in which he had already done Legend at this point, and they touch on that. And in addition to all these like video special features, which you should, you just should pick this up. In addition to all those things, there are so many written essays and production notes that come with this. I will outline these specifically. There's Into the Heart of Darkness by Nicholas Clement, which is more of like an overview essay about the movie and its impact and how it was made. There is Legends of Darkness, The Enduring Appeal of Dangerous Fairy Tales by Kate Ellinger, which gets into how that Brothers Grimm influence plays out in the movie. We have Designing Darkness by Simon Ward, more special features about the design of this movie. I can't stress enough how beautiful the production design is in this movie. We have the original production notes, which were from the official press kit when this movie came out. There is Making a Legend, which is written by the late great William Schwartzberg, and it's the introduction to a limited edition book of his screenplay published by Harvest Moon in 2002. We have, so a fun fact about Ridley Scott. which is why he's perfect for this podcast. If you are a physical media nerd, there's a name that you might not know, but you may know about a little bit. His name is Charles De Lauzerica, who is the man who is in charge of Ridley Scott's Blu-rays in director's cuts and multiple cuts. Like, this man is responsible for every Blu-ray release that has, like, multiple cuts of Blade Runner and just every Ridley Scott. Like, if you're a dork like me, this is, like, the man deserves a Lifetime Achievement Award for the work he was doing in the aughts on, like, Ridley Scott Blu-rays. It sounds so silly to say out loud, but this is a job I have envied my entire life. If there's a director who wants me to sift through archival material and put out dope Blu-rays of things, call me. This is by Andy Durson, which is, like, he sits down and he talks to Charles about, like, his process on making this, you know, this like insane version of this Blu-ray. And then there's just some notes about the restoration. With all that in mind, I wish I could say more about the movie. I just think you should check it out. This is a movie I would beg to have played at the IE Cinema. I don't even think people would like it very much. It's just beautiful to look at. And I don't even care which version of the movie you play. Both perfectly suited for a dark space with a crowd of people just sitting, chilling, and just letting it wash over you. But barring that, because this is a home video podcast, please, if you have the money, buy this special edition from Arrow Video. I mean, I didn't even mention like the other things that come with it. It comes with a reversible poster, which has the newly commissioned art that's on front of the box, as well as the original poster art. Both have their own different charms. It comes with lobby cards with still images photographed by Anne Leibovitz. Maybe you've heard of her. I don't know why I called her Anne. It's Annie Leibovitz. And just, guys, it's my first pick of the month. Legend. You can find it at Arrow Video right now. And for my final film of the month, we have Neil Jordan's Mona Lisa. Now, I am sadly not as well-versed in Neil Jordan's filmography as I really want to. I'm like a huge fan of Interview with a Vampire, which is like, I would say, his most famous film, I guess you... No, that's not his most famous film. His most famous film is quite obviously The Crying Game. I guess there might be a generational thing there, but that is what he won a Best Original Screenplay nomination for at the Academy Awards. He's famous for such other movies as, which I mentioned oddly early on this podcast, Greta. But, you know, things like Michael Collins and In the Company of Wolves. And I think he did Breakfast on Pluto. He's a very fascinating filmmaker, very visually interesting filmmaker. I'd say that's probably the theme for my pick of the month this week. But Mona Lisa is his third feature film. Interestingly enough, there's some weird overlap with... with Legend, in that the cinematographer for Legend, Alex Thompson, was the cinematographer for Excalibur, which I forgot to mention, which is a John Borman film. And on that same film, Neil Jordan was a creative associate, and John Borman would later go on to produce at least one Neil Jordan movie, Angel, but he might have produced more. But Mona Lisa is a 1986 film starring late great Bob Hoskins, which there's never gonna be another one like him, in kind of a softy role. It also stars Kathy Tyson, who steals the movie in a bravura performance, and a minor but very important role from Michael Caine. And it's about Bob Hoskins getting out of prison. He used to work with Michael Caine. They used to be more on like level footing, but now Michael Caine's kind of a big boss. And Michael Caine kind of tosses him this job as the chauffeur for a sex worker played by Kathy Tyson. And that is kind of the extent of his job. Bob Hoskins has a strained relationship with his daughter that he is hoping to repair. And while driving this sex worker around, Kathy Tyson, he starts developing feelings for her. But this being a neo-noir, he gets involved in some things that he's not expecting to get involved with. And honestly, I don't really want to say much more about the movie than that. I don't even want to tell you one of my favorite actors that pops up in this movie. But if you're a fan of David Simon shows, look out for a very young this person. But it's a very lurid film, and I admit that. But it's it's a sweet film because it's about a man who has fallen in love with this woman, and this woman, for reasons she can't really say, is like she can't reciprocate it back that way. And it's interesting watching them rub off on each other and him kind of like build up this like confidence in himself to like play this role as, you know, essentially he has to kind of become her, and I'm putting these in heavy square quotes, pimp, because that is not what this, the type of movie that this is at all. Like I said, I don't really want to say more about it, but it is a beautiful movie about watching two people have like a mutual affection for each other, even if the affection isn't the same affection. Kathy does care about Bob in this movie. I'm gonna just sound like a broken record this episode. It's so beautifully shot. When he's going to like the London Underground, and this is like Thatcher London, which I don't mean to glamorize, like I do the same thing from New York sometimes. I don't mean to glamorize like the grittiness of it, but there is a texture to it. And the way he lights it with like the red and blue Argento lighting or bisexual lighting, whichever you choose to subscribe to, it looks great. And also, it's just kind of a funny movie. Like Robbie Coltrane, who's most famous for playing Hagrid in the Harry Potter movies, is the mechanic that he kind of checks in with for the job and is his friend, and just their little asides about a book that he's reading. But then like Bob Hoskins is like, I should write a book. And that being like the thing that like breaks the movie up. It's great. I can't recommend this enough. It makes me really do want to get more into Neil Jordan's filmography, even though I know it's probably like all over the place because he's a fascinating director. But I feel very strongly about this movie. It's sweet, it's compelling, it hits you in your gut, but also your heart, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Michael Caine's great in his like five very important scenes, or whatever it is. I can't recommend this enough. Criterion did a great job putting this out. There are some great special features in this, including an essay, which I quite enjoyed reading, giving some like context on the film in Jordan's style. There is a audio commentary from 1997 featuring Neil Jordan and actor Bob Hoskins. There's a new conversation with Neil Jordan and Kathy Tyson. That was a fascinating conversation to see how they reflect on the film after all these years. There is a interview from 2015 with screenwriter David Leland, who gets into what it's like collaborating with Neil Jordan, as well as Stephen Hooley. There's an interview with Neil Jordan and Hoskins from the 1986 Cannes Film Festival, another piece of delightful archival footage. Mona Lisa, please check it out from Criterion Collection. That's going to do it for me on Physical Media's And Dead It Just Smells Funny this month. Like I said up top, the reason this had to be a little more truncated, a little more forward moving, is because I am a programmer at the Heartland International Film Festival. So if you are in the Midwest or can make it out last minute, if you're just like that down, you missed some stuff at the New York Film Festival, I guess. That is happening from the 7th through the 17th. I'm very excited about some things that are programmed. And you know, if you have it in you, I know that we have things like the French Dispatch and Spencer and Mass and King Richard. But take a look at some of the smaller films. Like, I feel very strongly that our program team did like a really good job, like trying to find the meat and potatoes films of the festival. I don't want to single out anything specifically, but like if you follow me on Twitter, like I made like a thread of things that I helped directly program that I'm very excited about. But I will be back soon, where I will be hopefully highlighting a Fun City Editions box set that just came out, possibly with a special guest, which is a September release. I'm just gonna give it its own time to shine. I have a new distributor that is an international distributor, so things are taking a little while to get to me. But after that, baby, I have some great things lined up for October. The October slate of films is very much my jam, so I hope you guys look forward to that. Thanks for bearing with me this month. Yeah, this has been Physical Media's And Dead Just Smells Funny. I'll see you at the movies. Good night.